The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Have you ever truly looked at color? Not in a cursory way or as a part of a landscape, but an intense study of, say, Oklahoma red dirt ochre, or turquoise blue, or a regal deep purple. For Keith Recker, my guest today, that's his job as a color trend consultant and forecaster for Pantone, a color matching company that works with designers in apparel, advertising, to packaging and industry. Recker has worked as an executive at Saks Fifth Avenue and Bloomingdale's, but in recent years, he's become concerned about the waste and unsustainability of much of the industries that utilize synthetic color creation. His return to old traditions and practices to create textiles and colors. Today, he's the creative director of the International Folk Art Market and the founder of Hand Eye Foundation and Magazine devoted to artisanal craft. His latest book is a beautiful book that demonstrates that the natural processes for creating vivid color in textiles is alive and well. True Color, World Makers of Natural Dyes and Pigments, features artisans from Africa, South and Central Asia, the Americas, and Europe who are still making fabric, textiles, and rugs the way their ancestors did. It also offers industry some sustainable practices as an alternative, and readers a deep engagement with color and the practices used to create it. Keith Recker is my guest today to talk about color in its natural state. Keith Recker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This book explores colors at their foundation, which contrasts with your previous book, which looked at how industry, fashion, advertising, entertainment uses color to convey messages. This book explores colors at their foundation. As you speak with artisans who've been dyeing and coloring with natural pigments, these processes go back, maybe millennia in some cases. Before we hear about some of those actions, I was struck by something you wrote at the very beginning of the book. You said, you write that color is narrative. What do you mean by that?
Color brings with it the stories of all of the people who've come before us. Our culture is encoded in color. The way we make decisions is extremely influenced by color. At Pantone, we talk about how 85% of our daily decisions use color input as part of the decision-making matrix. So it's just part of the way we receive the world, the way we express the world, the way we remember the world. It's right in there at the base of how we interact with the whole reality.
I get that message of how color can influence us, but I think it's subconscious and unconscious for most of us. Can you give us an example of how that works?
The 6.4 million color receptors in our retina can pick up the physical cues, but it's really our mind, right, that gives these different color cues values. So some values are really cultural specific. In Oaxaca, for example, the orange of a marigold is the scent and color that attracts the spirits of the dearly departed back for a visit across the 2 days of the Day of the Dead festival in late October, early November. And in India, the orange of the marigold stands for the flame of self-purification, which is really a symbol of the pursuit of the best in us, our tendency for our souls to head towards the divine. So you see those two subtly different messages are encoded in the same flower and the same color, but yet very different.
Of course, an orange I think of, the first thing I think of is harvest.
Right, yeah. Because that's part of our natural experience, right, with the squashes and the fall vegetables.
Now, you mentioned Pantone. I have to ask before we get into the book, one of your jobs is to be a color forecaster. Yeah. What is a color forecaster?
Well, a color forecaster is tasked with looking 2 to 3, sometimes a little bit longer, years into the future to figure out what people will need. What will the emotional and spiritual needs of people look like? What will the physical circumstances of people require? What will they feel? And then it's our job to translate some satisfying colors, motifs, patterns, forms, for use by designers and retailers so that consumers can be happy and satisfied and intrigued by what's on offer.
Are we naturally attracted to different colors, different sort of patterns in our fashion, depending on the outside world around us? When times are good, do we look to certain colors? when times are tight or, you know, in recession? Do we look at other colors?
Yes, indeed. You know, we could use the recession as a really good example of how we react in times of crisis, for example. So on the one hand, during the Depression, there was a lot of sort of sober, serious, strong, stable color because things needed to last, right? Things needed to be of value and have a promise to last and perform because you couldn't waste a dime. But then on the other side of the spectrum, this is when Crayola crayons were invented, when the Monopoly board with all of those crazy colors was invented, when Technicolor, think of the Wizard of Oz's surprising break from black and white into Technicolor. That was all from the Depression era because we needed to be drawn out of our sense of troubles. So we needed both things, right? The stability and sobriety as well as the entertainment and relief.
Well, the book is True Colors is a call for fashion and industry also to think about natural ways to present color. I don't know. I can't imagine that the synthetic color creation process is not filled with pollution, but what is the process like? Does it create a lot of pollution?
It does create a lot of pollution. A lot of synthetic dyes are made from petrochemicals, which, you know, sort of sidles up to a little statistic that people have been talking about lately. The fashion industry has been described as the second most polluting industry just behind oil and mining extraction.
Wow.
And, you know, part of that comes from the inputs, right? What makes the chemicals? How are the chemicals made? Part of it comes from the way the garments themselves are made and how waste is disposed of. If you're using petrochemicals, you are creating effluent that has to be managed. But, you know, overall, in addition to all of that, what we see now, I think mostly from the fashion industry, is a way of making and designing that results in product that is perceived only with the values of a disposable thing. We're consuming clothing at five times the rate we did in the 1980s, and there's an 80% chance that any garment we buy today will find its way to landfill within a year.
Wow.
So when you think about the big system that churns out inexpensive product, it is really not doing the earth any favors, whether it's through the manufacturing scenario or through the scenario of use. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to show people that there is a historic, cultural, poetic, personal value to natural color. And I believe that if we start to embrace product that has that kind of a depth, we're going to be attached to it. We're going to value it. We're going to care for it. We might even find ways to prolong its life by re-dyeing it or mending it or making it into something else. And our consumption pattern, our impact on the earth will lessen, not out of sacrifice, not out of some sense of penance, but out of a sense of joy and involvement with the things that we own and the things that we live with.
In the book, you detail a widely various group of artisans that are creating clothing, rugs, various processes, using a variety of natural dye processes. And you start with an artisan that many of us would falsely perhaps say works with an absence of color, the color white, Brigitte de Vos.
That's right. Brigitte is a Dutch artist. She had a long career in the fashion world, a lot of it fighting some of the things that I just mentioned, you know, wanting to make clean products, product that would endure. And I think at a certain point, she woke up realizing that her to-do list was killing her, and she really needed to create a refuge for herself. So her involvement with white, natural whites of calcium and wax, and old whites like decommissioned clothing from European convents, her involvement in that was part of a year-long art practice where she created a white project every day. And out of that discipline emerged a sense of peace and a sense of focus. And it's her feeling that by sort of cleansing her mind, she became hyper-aware of what was going on around her and hyper-creative, better at what she did. So white, can be a bit of a refuge.
The first area that you really focus on in the book is involving, this has got to be an ancient process, mud cloth.
Yeah, mud cloth is a West African tradition. They call it Bogolan Fini, which means made with mud in one of the languages of West Africa. And In the most poetic description, divers go down to the bottom of the Niger River in the spring, in March, when the spring rains are washing silt down from the highlands of the Guinea Mountains and across the border into Mali. And this fine, fine, dark silt is dredged up and put in clay vessels, usually which are sort of buried, half buried, so that they're insulated from temperature change. And they're fermented for about a year. And in that fermentation and settling time, mud becomes an iron-rich sort of slip, which handles a lot like paint. And on properly prepared fabric, that will, of course, leave a really beautiful dark, dark black-brown color. Really gorgeous. In a less poetic description of it, people go into ponds and dig up the muck at the bottom of a stagnant pond and use it. But I like the river description so much more.
But what I was surprised was I was used to that sort of dark brown color, but they get a wide diversity of color. That surprised me about a lot of these natural processes. And I think I was struck by something you wrote in the introduction. Michelle Whiplinger, many years ago when you were working at Saks, said, came up to you and said, you know, I can create every Pantone color with natural dyes. And you kind of were dismissive. And then later she showed you, you can create every color that can be created synthetically through natural processes, pretty much.
True. It's true. For the record, I was politely dismissive with Michelle. I just changed the subject. However, she made her way to my office a couple of months later and brought with her four sample cases of yarn hanks made with various combinations of natural substances in various dye vats with sometimes an aluminum mordant or an iron mordant or over dyes or additives, which are called modifiers. And she really did have the complete spectrum. She was right. She could make with natural substances any color I could possibly want. And she's really the one who opened my eyes to the possibilities of natural color. As a kid growing up in the U.S. in the 70s, very few people talked about natural color in the mainstream. You know, it was some interesting folks off at the fringes, you know, boiling up cauldrons of this or that, but it wasn't part of the main dialogue. And she really got me started on this path.
My guest today is Keith Recker. He is a color trend consultant and forecaster for Pantone and the founder of Hand Eye Magazine and Foundation, which helps artisans bring their creations out to a wider market. And he's also the author of Pantone, 20th Century in Color. And his new book is titled True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a beautiful book filled with every color along the spectrum of color, created by natural artisans using natural dyes and ancient processes. We were talking about mud cloth earlier. There's a design by Boubacar Doumbia. This beautiful tapestry could be in a museum. It is so beautiful. And again, I think of mud cloth as sort of being one color, but there's a whole range of very subtle pigments that are involved, depending on how you adjust that coloring process and dyeing process.
Yeah, that's right. In order to achieve that deep, dark black brown that mud cloth is famous for, you have to apply the mud four or five times. And if you just stop at each step, you know, applying once or applying twice or applying three times, you end up with these really fine variations of warm grays. And that's pretty elegant, right? We love grays these days, particularly in the home for its softness and its flexibility. So just breaking the process down, you know, you can get lots of different effects. But the same is true with indigo.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful two-page photograph in the book that describes the 12 shades of West African indigo, Yoruba indigo. And they run from the palest, almost not there at all, blue, to the most profound blue-black, which is actually considered a symbol of the divine in Mali. It refers to the mysterious darkness from which we're born and the mysterious darkness to which we will return. It's very evocative.
Yeah, and, you know, that was another example. I think of indigo as sort of creating this beautiful bursting out blue, but as you mentioned, it produces nearly any shade of blue depending on how you adjust the process. The other thing I found interesting about indigo was, you know, I knew it was a plant, but I really didn't know much about the plant itself. And, you know, the idea that a green plant produces blue, and there's some wonderful photographs of showing artisans working with that green plant and watching the blue pigment come out of this green plant is just sort of mind-blowing in a way.
Well, it's true. There's a two-page sequence in the book that traces the indigo process as pursued by Living Blue, which is a group based in Bangladesh that has returned indigo cultivation to Bangladesh after more than a century of absence. There's a history to that return. When the British no longer had access to the slave-driven plantations of indigo in the Carolinas because of the American Revolution, they took their business to Bangladesh. And slavery was technically illegal, so they set up instead a vicious cycle of company store-style loans.
Right.
Farmers in a terrible position of debt and stress. And the farmers finally rose up and had the Indigo Revolt of 1859 and 60. And they were put down very brutally. Gandhi is said to have studied the Indigo Revolt of 1859 when he was developing his doctrine of nonviolent protest. So it had a far-reaching historic effect. But indigo had a bad connotation in Bangladesh. Even though the plant is ready to grow in the fields of Bangladesh with no irrigation, no fertilizer, no pest control, it really was not pursued. But recently, CARE International, a U.S. nonprofit, their social venture division, helped farmers and dyers band together in a cooperative structure. And now they're successfully growing among the finest indigo that I know of in the world today. So beautiful, so good that it's being used by luxury brands like Hermès in Paris. They often have collaborative relationships with Living Blue folks. It's a really beautiful revival of indigo in that part of the world.
I'm glad you brought up that history, because that's the other part of indigo. Was indigo was sort of an exploitative crop that Westerners used to keep their colonial subjects in subjugation. And when fashions changed, those farmers often were sort of on the losing end on both sides of the coin.
Yeah, left with nothing. It's true. When synthetic dyes were invented in 1856, one of the first broadly applied commercial colors that came out of that was a synthetic indigo. It was made in large part by the German company that became BASF, the maker of cassette tapes, for those of us, right, who were in that era.
Right. And another forgotten process.
Exactly. And interestingly, the first synthetic indigo was seen to be too garish and too startlingly lapis lazuli, as you mentioned. And the chemist had to go back and really look at what made indigo so beautiful. And what they realized was that there's not just indigo in the indigo vat. There's also indirubin, which is a natural red that starts to form at slightly higher temperatures. And it was this small presence of a natural red that made indigo so rich and so satisfying. So they had to go back and imitate the beautiful complexity of nature in order to get a dye that people were fond of.
From indigo, and there's several different artisans using indigo, you go to another ancient natural dye to create blue. I've never heard of this before. It was, I guess, something in the British Isles called woad. Am I saying that right?
You are. Yes, woad is a plant from the mustard family. And the word woad is related to the word weed, which is altogether fitting because woad is an invasive alien in the majority of the lower 48 states. You actually are forbidden from cultivating it because it's just so invasive. But it was the source of blue for Europeans before indigo crept into global commerce. And it was so economically important that Queen Elizabeth I actually issued an edict limiting the acreage in the fields that could be devoted to woad as opposed to food production. Right? People were really rushing toward the cash, and she was worried that the realm wouldn't be fed. Also, the woad process, like a lot of indigo processes, used to use stale urine as a way to create the alkaline environment needed in the fermentation vat, and it stank. And so part of her edict also said that woad workshops had to be further than a few miles away from any of her residences because she didn't like the smell.
It's hygiene, early hygiene regulation.
Early hygiene. So woad is a gorgeous plant, and it, unlike the indigo plant itself, maintains a slightly greenish quality. So it can make these beautiful turquoises and cooler blues. It's also quite beautiful.
Yeah. I was struck by some of the ways these dyes are created. In the New World, the sea snail they call Tixina by the Mixtecs people. Really interesting, creating this amazing color from sea snails.
Yes, it's true. That's right. Along the Pacific coast of Oaxaca, in a place called the Costa Chica, there is a sea snail. Scientifically, it's the Purpura Panza. And this sea snail has been used by the Mixtec for at least 1,500 years and probably longer. They go to the coast. They pluck the sea snail off of the wet rocks at low tide. And they milk the snail for about a thimbleful of this sort of goo, which is really a neurotoxin, which they use to paralyze their prey, which is usually other smaller shellfish called lapas. It's a kind of a limpet. And this neurotoxin, if you apply it directly to a skein of cotton yarn, because the fiber of the Americas was really cotton, oxidizes in the air into this beautiful red-violet color. And the Mixtec have been sustainably managing this resource for many centuries. They understand that it takes the snails about a month to recharge, so they never fish a cove more than once a month, and they don't do anything at all during the snail's mating season. So their traditions have a rhythm to them that is respectful of nature. But what's happening now to this beautiful red-violet color is that tourism has arrived to this once remote part of the world, and local fishermen are harvesting the purpura panza and chopping it up to serve as ceviche to visitors.
Oh, my gosh.
And the snail population is plummeting. The dying group used to be able to dye many dozens of skeins of yarn, sometimes double and triple dye, to get these beautiful glossy dark purples. And now they can barely get 20 skeins of single dyed yarn across a whole harvesting season.
So this is a process that may be dying out in our lifetime.
Yes, indeed. Maybe in the next 5 years. They are conducting a community education program to try to encourage local fishermen not to harvest that kind of snail. And like all community education programs, it requires, you know, a lot of persistence to create that change. And hopefully it'll happen. They're definitely making the effort. But we are at that place where we could see the end of this well within our lifetimes.
Mm. My guest today is Keith Recker. His new book is titled True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments, in which he talks with artisans and fuse their process across the world of creating natural color and natural dyes from these sea snails, Tixinda, or cochineal beetles, marigold petals, from a variety of materials in the Southwest to create ochre and browns and earth colors. I was talking about the cochineal beetles. That's another that creates a really stunning pinkish-red color.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that's also millennia old. The ancestors of current-day Zapotec people, also of Oaxaca, domesticated this beetle to increase the amount of carminic acid contained in the bodies of the females of the species. And it's this carminic acid which produces a beautiful range of reds. I spent a few days with the Gutierrez Contreras family at their workshop, and over the course of a couple of days, we made 26 different shades of red, coral, orange, violet, and purple just with the cochineal beetle. Interestingly, we have had, as North Americans, more contact with cochineal than one might think. Cochineal makes up a red colorant called E120, I believe, and it is still the safest red colorant that we know of, and it's used in cosmetics and certain foodstuffs. So the next time you pick up a beautiful red lipstick, you know, you might be having Beetlejuice.
Your travels took you literally to every corner of the world. I'm looking now at the section devoted to an artisan named Fatio Kandayev. I may be saying his name wrong. He's a Uzbek in Central Asia. And you're describing the process to get the vivid red that marks the carpets that you see from Central Asia, from Tajikistan, from Uzbekistan, these beautiful vivid reds that are in the carpets. And it comes from a plant root.
Yes, it does. It comes from the root of the madder plant. And the madder plant has been used for its dyestuffs for many, many thousands of years. Where Fatilo lives is a city called Bukhara, which is definitely worth the very long trip to Uzbekistan because you feel like you're stepping back 1,000 years in certain places of the town, with the beautiful mosaic-colored buildings and the bazaars with product on offer and the architecture. It's an amazing place. And Fatilo re-explored the free synthetic use of natural dyes after the fall of the Soviet Empire, right, in 1991. He relearned this trade and opened up a school, a UNESCO-funded carpet-making and natural dye school in 1997. And madder is one of the traditional colors that he needed to master because of how often it's used in the embroidered textiles and in the rugs. Madder comes from Rubia tinctoria, the plant that's used in dyeing, is actually a strain derived from a wild madder plant. And the wild madder plant was across the Mediterranean and up through the Middle East. And we think that it's possible that the madder plant got a lot of attention because it contains a natural anti-diarrheal component. It has a natural antiviral effect. And we often see relationships between medicine plants and color plants.
Yeah, no, it creates beautiful color from those rugs that are just amazing. We have very little time left, but I do want to mention ochre, because, you know, I'm looking at the work of Heidi Gustafson, you know, who's creating all sorts of pigments from ochre. And I just think of, in Oklahoma, just 50 miles west of us, is the red earth country. You know, we get this red, vivid red earth that that is a great source of color.
It is. It is, right? That comes from the combination of iron and oxygen, two of the prevalent elements in, you know, in the composition of the earth and its atmosphere, and also in the human body, right?
Yeah.
And interestingly, the use of red ochre goes back past humanity.
Right.
There's plenty of evidence that Neanderthal people were fascinated with red ochre based on burial sites, and this goes back maybe 300,000 years. Humanity also has been fascinated by red ochre from the very, very beginning with archaeological evidence. We don't know what they were using it for in many cases, but archaeological evidence goes back over 100,000 years. One of the things that I love about what Heidi brings to the book is that she and I both have a fascination with the fact that Adam, the first man in the Western tradition, his name means red earth. Right? And the spot where many, many people think the Garden of Eden might have actually been is in the Persian Gulf. And right there in the Gulf is the island of Hormuz, which is the site of an incredibly ancient red ochre mine. And Heidi shared a couple of pictures that show how splendid and vivid the red earth is in that part of the world.
So that would be
no
the,
accident.
There would be a picture of miners, and literally they're red from head to toe.
It's true, and the geese they keep for their eggs, right, are also pinkish red because they're just infiltrated with the dust. It's really something.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned several high-end fashion people embracing this use of color, the indigo farmers in Bangladesh, and utilizing their natural dyes for their process. How widespread is that in industry? Is that just a nascent beginning?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I think consumers are beginning to smell the need to change our consuming habits. And the most adventuresome folks in the design world are reacting to that initial awareness. We have a long way to go. I'm hoping very hard that this message sticks and that we find ways to shift towards natural components, grown responsibly, used responsibly, disposed of responsibly, and that the product that we touch every day is made better and with more meaning so that we don't run through it as if it was trash. Yeah. We have to become a little more attached and a little more careful and a little more considered in what we buy and how long its lifespan is in our lives. Those steps alone would create a lovely difference in the kind of impact we make as people on this planet.
Keith Recker, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Keith Recker is a color trend consultant and forecaster for Pantone and the founder of the Hand Eye Magazine and Foundation. His latest book is titled True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. It's published by Thrums. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.